Let's press that.
Introducing the new catastrophe tier for the Rails to Nowhere podcast.
Wow, it works. Sorry, I've made a little clap noises. Okay, GarageBand is going. I have battery. It is working. You can hear me. I'm going to open
up. I can hear you. Oh, I should probably turn my noise suppression off, shouldn't I?
Yeah, because
that's going to be cutting me out.
The other thing is, if you go into voice and video in your Discord settings, I agree.
Voice and video. Oh yeah, and I want to reduce my sensitivity just a little bit.
Yeah, just so it's more likely to
pick me up. Yeah, so it's not cutting me off. Is that coming through nicely for you? I can hear you nice and clearly. The problem is you can probably that is the problem with turning off my noise suppression.
Turn on the noise suppression.
Okay, let's turn on the noise
suppression. But leave the activity thing where it was and give it a shot.
Yep, I stand by.
Are they drilling?
Okay, so not at the moment. They've stopped drilling
now.
Were
they drilling when we were talking earlier?
They were drilling when we were talking earlier.
Okay, I couldn't hear it, and it's not really affecting things badly.
Cool. Let's leave it as we are now. Then I've got my sensitivity down, and I've got my noise suppression on. That's just going to have to be how it's going to be today.
Yep. And if anyone, it's not like this is professional. Okay.
Hello, and a special welcome to our lovely patrons to this, our first new format Patreon bonus episode. In this style, we're looking to make the bonus episodes a little bit more laid back, hopefully with slightly less editing on my part. It'll still be sort of the same thoughtful content. Indeed, in this episode, it's probably going to be a little bit ranty at times. But as I say, hopefully with a little less editing and a sort of more sort of fireside chat feel. As ever, I'm Simon, and joining me is Ella.
Hi. This is going to go well.
So, as you can tell, Ella is terrified of podcasts. It's been over a year now. It's been like 6 months since we recorded, and we have forgotten how to do this.
Yes, and this is this topic today is one that I have quite literally just had a chat about like 2 days ago at the university, and it was interesting.
But Ella's got a mug of tea. I've got a mug of hot black currant. So we're ready for today's episode. But we are ready for today's episode.
Yes.
On the historiography of British Railway and its relationship with technology.
Yes.
So the notes I've got are a bit Socratic.
Yeah.
I think it's important for something as complex and involved as historiography to start off a little bit sort of Socratic method. And so on this piece of paper in front of me, I've got written the words, what is historiography and what is history?
Yes.
So historiography, I mean, at its core, it's the study of history.
Yeah,
It's
a very difficult thing to discuss, and it gets very philosophical.
Yeah, but it's essentially the history of how history has been studied and written.
Yes.
And at its core, it's understanding why history has or hasn't been discussed in the way it is. So why my writings on, say, the Roman Empire in the... me writing now in the 21st century about the Roman Empire, why my perspective and what I would write would be different to what Pliny the Elder wrote back in the contemporary era when he was writing Roman history from the perspective of the Roman Empire being ongoing.
Yes, and it's one of these things that is very important to discuss because it informs the debates that we later go on to have.
Yeah.
As history is a discourse, which is some, because it's a postmodernist's view, but yeah. I think a lot of modern history now is very much a discourse rather than a purely narrative based seeking a truth.
Yeah. And I think it's very important to talk about historiography and to understand what it is, because all too often we see stuff about revisionist historians in the news and revisionism, and they're changing history, they're changing the past.
Mm.
And often what people are complaining about is actually historiography in action. And hopefully through today's chat, I'm going to explain why I feel that historiography is vital and important, and why it is a necessary good in the world that it exists, and why revisionism. The problem is revisionism can both be good and be bad, because we've got revisionism such as, say, we're seeing in the Russian government's revisionism of Russian history to justify its invasion of Ukraine, where they're saying, well, look, we can see that Ukraine and Russia have always been the same nation throughout their history. And that's the sort of revisionism that can be bad, because that's trying to push a aggressive imperial attitude. But most importantly, it's trying to drown out the plurality of voices that could exist within the discourse. So it's trying to drown out those voices that say, actually, Ukraine has its own strong and independent voice, or those voices saying, actually, Russia is its own distinct thing from, say, the previous Kiev and Rus, perhaps. On the other side, you have the sort of revisionism that is good. You have the sort where those who have not been enabled to be represented within history, or have their voices and their interpretation of history heard, get to have that heard. And that's where you sort of have things like the Black Lives Matter movement, black history, queer history, all of those sort of things, where as we enable those groups who've been excluded from the discussion before to speak and engage in that conversation, we find that they bring new and different perspectives. They see importance in events that have perhaps been overlooked, or they actually turn around and say, that event you think you understand because you're, let's be frank, nice middle-class white male history narrative that you've written that's made you feel comfortable about it. So something like the civil rights movement, where the sort of traditional narrative was, oh, well, there were the civil rights acts and then everything was good. You then actually start introducing those sort of black voices into the discussion. They go, actually, that narrative is all about sort of patting yourselves on the back.
Yes, when obviously we sit and we look at the events that follow things like the Civil Rights Act, and actually things didn't massively improve. I actually wrote an essay on this in my second undergraduate year on the state, basically what was more important to certain communities in America at the time of the civil rights movement, like in the years after, and the civil rights movement, the Civil Rights Acts. What I was basically able to find and wrote essentially argued that while they were important, the more important thing was the provision of a new bus route through the neighborhood, because that was what actually enabled these people to get what they were fighting for, more than a law saying you have to do this. Often for these people, it was actually, oh, we need access to stuff. And it's a bit of a falsehood in some ways to say that, you know, this one event maybe
changed everything. So I think the other important thing that we need to understand at this point is is what is the concept of history? Like, what is history? And there's kind of two definitions here, because obviously if we're talking about just what is history as a concept, then obviously we're talking about it as being events in the past. But when we're talking about history as an academic discipline, it's a little bit nebulous. There's some slightly different definition, but at its core, the study of history is the study of past events and their interpretation and understanding for the reader. Most specifically, it can also be brought down to be the study of written sources, so which can differentiate it from disciplines such as archaeology and anthropology, which are more interpreting physical sources, so things like archaeology obviously interpreting the actual buildings and geographic landscapes that were used in the past,
as one would say, the physical record on the environment.
Yeah, which of course is why we get the sense that there's a prehistory, because there is a time from before we had written down records, and that's prehistory. An important thing to note, and this is of course part of how me and Ella fit into the historiography here, is of course that this can be a quite European way of viewing what history is, because you move out of Western European ways of working and you move into places like Africa or Native American tribes, and history is not written down. It isn't. There are no written records for interpretation. It's all oral history. It's all relayed through oral tellings and stories, and history becomes something very different. So it is important to note that what we're discussing today is very much a European way of viewing history. It's very much a modern way of viewing history for many other parts of the world.
It's not necessarily the right way either. It is one method.
But specifically, it's the way that our culture views history and works with history. And so that's why it's important in our study for us to understand this. So, because, of course, we're interpreting the written evidence, we're interpreting what people have written down and left behind, that's where historiography comes into play, because I will view written records with one lens, Ella will view them with a different lens, and everyone else will view them with another lens, and we will understand them differently. And, of course, the different written sources that we could have will have different agendas behind them.
And so the access to the source is also very important. Where is the source from? With something like an archive, you've got this interesting power dynamic developing between the historian or the person accessing the material, the person who created the material, the entity that created the material, and then the archive and the archivists themselves, who at the end of the day are the ones who dictate what goes into an archive.
And what stays in there.
Yeah, what stays in. And also even things like the records entered into the catalogue, which are in many cases, I think in most cases actually, are the first touch first interaction that someone will have with a source in an archive. And that can really shape and change your views and opinions. It might be incorrect what's written on that record. It might be just something as nebulous as company accounts, or something as detailed as the company accounts for the, for the local branch of Lloyd's Bank in 1922 when John C. Ray, whatever, was chairman.
And I think it's fair to say that both of us, and probably most historians, have gone into an archive and we've looked at their catalogue and seen a completely, a really detailed record and gone, oh, that's what I want, looked at it, and it's like it's nothing like what the record said. But then you also get these things, it's just like letter, you open it and you're like, this is the golden ticket for what I'm doing.
Yeah. I had a couple of those when researching for my undergraduate dissertation, opening up a couple of things were just kind of labeled as communication and opening it up. And then this whole world falls out onto your lap and you're looking at these documents. You're like, hang on. There's so much here that isn't, I need to speak to someone and be like, do you realize what is in this folder?
Yeah. And I know I was watching I was watching an online seminar from the curator of the TFL archives, which I've used extensively for my dissertation. And they were talking about how they've been working over the last year to bring to life a project to improve those descriptions and to improve the access to some of those records. They've been digitizing and transcribing the minutes of the Underground Electric Railway.
Which has limitations as well.
Yeah, which has its limitations, and they were engaging with some of those. But one of the big things they were doing, which I love as a way to enable more people to access the history, is they were typing out the handwritten records, which means that they're actually easier to access and easier to read. Obviously, they were engaging with the fact that that has limitations. There could be transcription errors,
and not just that, and so on. You can tell a lot from handwriting too.
Yeah.
What I find some of the most interesting things that I've seen in my travels and my time in archives has been things where you've got a lovely typewritten document and then scrawled in the corner very hastily is like, this is all wrong, this is terrible, I hate this. And that tells so much. And there's a limitation to type transcribing them. But then there's also this wonderful benefit that more people can access it. So it's very difficult how you preserve stuff.
Yeah. And so the big thing here is that, of course, this means that our understanding of history and the history that's being produced is ever changing and ever shifting, be it because my perspective is different to one of someone in the 1950s or 1970s who was writing about the public transport in London. My concerns are different. I have, for example, I have global warming much more prominently in my mind than, say, someone who was writing in the 1970s. And that influences how I view the positives or negatives of policies that organisations may have been having to make in the 1930s. And I fully believe that we can ascribe, was that a good or a bad decision based on our modern understanding of the issue? But that means that my interpretation and my understanding will be different. But then, as Ella says, you also have the issue of access to sources. One of the best examples of this I saw recently on Twitter was someone discussing the change in how World War II history was written pre and post the Bletchley Park information being known about. So in the 1960s, you get lots of Second World War histories that are sort of like, oh, wow, the British were really lucky in that they guessed that there was going to be this raid here, or guessed that this was going to happen, or guessed that that was going to happen, because they didn't know we'd cracked Enigma when they were writing those texts. Then the records get opened up. People go, oh, wow, they actually didn't guess. It wasn't luck. Actually, it was a fantastic piece of code breaking and then strategy and all of that based on information. And that, again, is the sort of thing that revolutionizes and changes how the history is understood.
And it's a very important thing to recognize too, because there's a lot of merit to looking at these old texts, these older histories too, and going, and not criticizing them for not knowing, but actually trying to understand what they were trying to understand too, because there's a lot that you can, that you miss now with our, you know, with our particular sensibilities that maybe they didn't miss, or what we might think of as silly, but they were thought of as a great idea.
And then, of course, the other thing that feeds into historiography is what my secondary school history teacher always used to bang into us: bias. What is the bias of the source? Both primary and secondary sources.
Yeah. which
you always have the question of what is the source trying to tell you? What's the narrative they want to see? Why is this record survived? What records might not exist? What are they excluding? What are they including? Can I deduce anything about those and why they might be doing that?
And while bias isn't the best of words to use, it's a good basic kind of introduction to the idea.
Yep.
Because bias itself isn't a very... It's a word that doesn't...
Yeah.
Fully describe what we're looking at, if you ask me. Yeah. We're looking at a much wider...
And some sources are deliberately biased. They're deliberately prejudicial or exclusionary for whatever reason. And sometimes they're just not attempting that per se actively, but they just have... They convey... A source conveys the message that its writer wants to convey. And it's important to engage with that. It's important to understand what they're trying to present, whether they're playing things up, playing things down.
Mm. What's the wider context of this piece, which is very important.
And that's the important thing. Somebody writing about, for example, if we look at a very well-studied section of history, say the trenches in the First World War, the letters of the general staff, the letters of the frontline trench soldiers in the trenches, the letters of people back in London will all convey different senses of what the war's like and what it's and what's occurring, because they all have a different perspective on it, because they all have a different series of motivations. And they're all trying to... So, for example, the letter from General Haig back to Britain to tell them how the Battle of the Somme is going will have a different series of messages that it's trying to convey than a letter from a private to his sweetheart who's perhaps being more honest about what conditions in the trenches are like. Equally, though, of course, in this instance, you also have aspects of censorship of those lower soldiers' letters as well, both self and centralized, because the government doesn't want that information getting out. And again, this is where you start asking the question of, so what is this not telling me? And this is where things like archaeology can begin to inform our understanding of the historical record as well. Because if all my letters are excluding the fact that there's loads of mud and it's really damp and horrible down in the trenches, but the archaeology is telling me that actually that's the conditions they would have been in, then I can start drawing a picture of, but why is nobody talking about this? And then I can begin to understand that there's an aspect of censorship, either formally from central command or self-censorship by the soldiers in what they're writing.
And this is the other thing as well, is that by saying using your World War One example, the censorship, not knowing if people also are subconsciously doing this, is this a conscious effort?
Yeah.
Is this actually something people want to be doing too? Because you often find some very interesting things where people are creatively writing around censorship as well, and because they know, or because they don't know and are instead just have a feeling that what they're saying could get them into trouble as well.
Yeah, and then of course, and you have the other question of, is it that the sergeant is sitting over them telling them, no, you can't write that? Or is it that they just don't want to worry their mother or their sweetheart back at home, or they want to try and encourage people to support the war by saying, yeah, it's going really well and it's good and we're getting on well or whatever. So you have all these motivations, and this is where reinterpretation and revisionism come in, because depending on my perspective and my life experience, I might view what I think motivations of the people writing it may have been different.
Mm.
So that then means that, of course, as a historian, it's important for us to understand where we fit within historiography, and that we have an idea of what's come before us. Mm. Anyone who's done a sort of big, long piece of historical writing, like myself and Ella have obviously both just finished our dissertations for our 2 degrees that we've just been doing.
Yeah.
And Ella's about to embark on yet another dissertation.
Yes.
A key part of that is what's called a literature review, which is where we write about the stuff that's come before us.
Yes. I'm and actually specifically, in the process of writing one.
Yeah, and specifically this is about talking about the secondary sources that have come before us. So it's important to note the difference between a primary and a secondary source. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with this distinction, but I'll just outline it broadly for those who aren't. A primary source is a source that is from the time. It's something that, yeah, so it's something like a letter from the time or a record. So, for example, for my dissertation, that would be the minute books of the London Passenger Transport Board. That's my primary, that's my principal primary source for my dissertation.
Yes, mine were a series of communications by the bailiff of Jersey to the bailiff of Guernsey and the 2 field commandants out there. And that they were letters, well, these were written by these people.
Meanwhile, a secondary source is some sort of historical writing that's been produced after the event. So a common one we use here is Gorvish's History of British Railways,
which is him
going in, looking at the secondary, at the primary sources, and writing a historical overview of those sources. Equally, for both of us, our dissertations are secondary sources because we've gone and looked at primary material, reinterpreted that, and written about it ourselves.
Yes, and
that's, you then get,
I was going to say, that's a very important distinction to make, is not to confuse the two, because you can end up making some bad conclusions, and also to remember that primary sources may masquerade as secondary sources, and that some secondary sources will attempt to masquerade as a primary source, and that's very important to remember too.
You always have that interesting question that I always have, things like newspapers, which can fall into both a secondary and a primary source, depending on what they're writing about. And then on top of that, you get tertiary sources. That's things that are writing about the history or something like that, but they are not doing any interpretation of themselves, and they're just picking out mostly secondary source material. So we'd be talking things like encyclopedias, things like Wikipedia. They're not there for historical interpretation. They're not there for providing a narrative per se. They're just there to list historical facts, list the events, and basically try and provide a factual view.
Yes, as I often give an example, it's most public history television.
Yes.
Which may go and look at a primary source, but often is not really providing any new interpretation of said source, and is instead merely resting on the work of other people, which is perfectly acceptable to do, actually.
Yeah, and it all has its place. All three of these have their place. They interact, they co-react. You don't tend to use, like, whilst using tertiary sources for evidence for a dissertation or something like that is generally frowned upon, sometimes you do find yourself feeding off them. And, like, generally I use things like tertiary sources as a starting point for looking for information, because it can often be a good lead board.
Yes, if we have anyone, I was going to say, if we have anyone who is either at A-level or in their first years at university, one of the best tools there is Wikipedia. Not as a thing to reference, but as a place to go and start, and then scroll down to the bottom, you will find some amazing citations in there that you did not know existed.
My dissertation pretty much started with looking at the London Passenger Transport Board page on Wikipedia, pulling out the secondary sources from that, and then diving into their primary sources. And I try and do a sort of bit of a literature review in the episodes that we have here on the podcast. Obviously, we're not going to go into a 1,500-word literature review every episode, because that's pretty much an entire episode.
Yes.
But we do talk a little bit about sources, and we'll talk a little bit about the merits of some of the changes in the understanding that's happened from time to time.
Yeah, and it's one of those things as well where you could make talk for hours about just one secondary material, one piece
indeed.
Of literature. Whereas, and while that's good to do, I'm sure you guys want more than us sitting here and arguing for 4 hours about Christian Wolmer's Broken Rails. It's Broken Rails, isn't it?
I think that's one of his books. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that brings us now to the actual extensive topic of this bonus episode, which is, of course, the historiography, which is the historiography of British railways, and specifically its relationship with technology. And this is quite an interesting topic and quite an interesting historiography, because it's been very fluid and it's been shifting and changing over time.
And everyone contributes to this, which is an important thing to point out. What you'll have, I think we can both say that we are to different demands professional historians, I think, at this point.
I'm still a professional historian, yes. I get paid to do history things.
Yeah, and one of us is leeching off the state for flights around the world to talk about stupid things, but we've that secrets for the future. But everyone from professional to proper full-time professionals that you'll see in universities, professors and other highly regarded academics, or to people like us, to just your A-level student, to your GCSE, to just people discussing this stuff on internet forums or down the pub. Everyone contributes.
And the historiography of British Railway is very, very intensely tied to our reinterpretation, our understanding of the history of the railways. And at the minute is massively being contributed to. Like, every time the RMT tweet out about how nationalisation would be great and solve everything, or privatisation was a disaster, every time the Guardian or the Financial Times or the Telegraph write an article about the merits of privatisation or nationalisation, every time the Daily Mail writes about how strikes destroyed the country in the 1970s and will destroy the country today, that's acting as a reinterpretation or a re-understanding or a addition to the historiography of the understanding of British Rail's past.
And the other important thing to say too is it's not necessarily most opinions actually aren't necessarily wrong, and we can disagree on opinions, and I think Simon and I, we disagree a lot on some stuff relating to British Rail, and on other things we totally agree. And I'll sit here and I'll have a chat with people like my friend Gareth Dennis off Rail Natter. We'll have a massive debate over, was this actually important or was this wrong? I will say that I think you're incorrect, and he'll say I think you're incorrect, and that's perfectly all right, because as I said before, history, at least in the form that we tend to practice it, I think, is more of a discourse than a trying to find true fact.
Yeah. And a significant thing with the historiography of the railways is it often focuses on technical details of often locomotives and rolling stock. I mean, I have big books behind me that are technical descriptions of underground trains, how the underground works or how signaling works. It also tends to focus on the big flashy things and the failures.
Yes.
So things like the A4s, things like the HSTs, those are the big flashy things.
And then you've got the APT. Massive failures.
Big failure, big high profile thing. And this is why throughout our BR Tech series that we're doing, I've tried to make the focus. Yeah, we discuss the big things. We discuss the HST. We touch on the APT. But we're also focusing on the smaller steps, the littler things that often get forgotten about in that narrative. So things like the TOPS, things like Southern Region AWS.
Yes, and even in the world of rolling stock, things like a new and improved boxcar, or when they finally came along, the container flat wagon, which I think most people overlook, but one could argue is, or was, and still is, the thing that shaped the modern freight railway.
Yeah, and also attempting to re-understand events like the modernization plan and actually contextualize it better and say, actually, it wasn't just a stupid idea, because it wasn't. No. And I hope when we've discussed about it in our episode, it came across that I don't think the modernization plan was in itself a bad idea. It was poorly executed. And as I think is a conclusion in most of our BR Tech episodes, the biggest hurdle it faced was the fact that BR was at the whim of the government. And again, this is one of those points where my understanding interpretation of the history of British Rail has changed and shaped over time, that I've come to realise that actually nationalisation is not a golden bullet per se. I think there's good methods of nationalisation, and I think small politics alert, I think the railways should be nationalised because I think they're a public good, but I also recognise that just nationalising it wouldn't automatically make it better.
No. And I think to kind of reinforce that point, I think a good modern day example is that of the Melbourne suburban rail network, which has, I think, experienced both the massive benefits that come with the privatised network and the massive failures of a privatised network. If you ask any Melbourne resident about, if you just say to them word Connex, you will get a very visceral reaction from a lot of them about poor service and sweltering trains in the Melbourne heat. But then you'll ask them about the current operator, PTG, which generally seems to have a much more positive reaction. And while that's still a private operator, and while people may disagree about is it perfect in everywhere, I think the general consensus over in Melbourne is that they're doing an okay job.
Yeah. And so if we look at the modernisation plan as an example here, the traditional narrative has always been that it's just a failure, that it was overambitious, that British Rail was unable to do it, it had poor organisational and decision-making skills, that it made bad decisions for political purposes. And specifically, there's a lot of criticism, for example, at Robert Riddle's for his attempts to pursue steam following nationalisation rather than immediate dieselisation. I know we talked a bit about that in our episode. But equally, there's a shift in that historiography to sort of contextualise that and actually rethink it. Because very often people are like, oh, well, but in France and Germany, they electrified and rebuilt their railways. But it's important to note that, as people like Jackson highlight in their works, one of the big differences there is that Britain never received the Marshall Plan aid that many continental countries did.
Yeah.
And so finance was much tighter in the UK than it had been in other parts of the country. Like, we still had rationing until the mid-1950s.
Yeah. And the other thing as well is that in France and Germany, quite frankly, Britain helped them a lot during the war. And even the retreating Germans did, because they tore up vast swathes of railway. And when you're having to rebuild from scratch.
Yeah, this is the other thing. It's like, in large chunks of Germany, they had no choice but to rebuild from scratch, because the combined armies of the world had marched through the Rhine region several times during the last 5 years. So...
And that lays waste so that's to your the railway.
Yeah, frankly. And that's an important part of the re-understanding of the narrative, and understanding that actually British Rail was operating within a very different set of parameters than continental railways. It's also important to note that there are successes of the modernisation plan. The electrification of the West Coast Main Line, while it was a bit late and a little bit over budget, was a success.
Yes.
And stood up well.
And it stood the test of time to the present day.
Yeah.
Because there are still biggest sections electrified using that original style of electrification, which means that while it has flaws, as I'm sure Gary Keenor will talk endless about, it clearly had some sticking power.
Yeah. And that one of the biggest limitations and failings of the modernization plan was really that it was stopped, and stopped for political reasons, because the government got scared. And this is one of those very key things with BR's historiography, is very often the reinterpretations actually go, well, one of the biggest problems was actually not necessarily that BR were incapable of doing stuff, but actually that the government wouldn't allow them to.
Yes.
Because their spending and their investment is subservient to the ongoing changes and whims of the government.
Yes, and I think we can point to many examples of how BR was actually a world leader in its research and in its development. If you want to lose half an hour of your life, look up on YouTube the British Rail, the Power to Stop video, and they talk and this research done into brake blocks. And if British Rail was privatized at that time, was still a private company, I don't think research like that would be done, because it was research for the sake of research.
Yeah, and this is very much something that comes in with the APT and the HST narrative as well, is the fact that actually the APT was a revolutionary and massively influential piece of equipment. And its biggest failing was actually the government not letting BR just carry on doing the research for the sake of research. And we also come with the HST, where the traditional narrative is that it's just a success story. It saved BR. It saved the day. But there are a number of approaches and more recently that sort of question that narrative and that sort of it saved the day. And this also the Pacer, we come in, so we get the two trains in the 70s and 80s. You get the HST, which is supposed to have saved intercity railways, and you get the Pacer, which is supposed to have saved rural railways. But more recent work, such as that by Kevin Tennant and David Turner, my supervisors for my course that I've just finished, they've recently released various bits of work which have highlighted the fact that actually the narrative that BR's network was significantly under threat in that period was actually probably overplayed in most sources. Realistically, the impact of the beaching cuts was such that actually there was no political will to close lines. And even if you look at places like the Settle to Carlisle, or the Cambrian coastline, for example, places that are often said to have been under threat, realistically, there just never was the political will to actually go through with any major closure post the beaching acts.
Because that was a significant act, and I think it would have been politically unviable to axe anything more.
Yeah, and significantly, it's important to note that the Pacers, that a lot of the lines that the Pacers are attributed with saving, either the Pacers didn't come to till much later, or actually the lines the Pacers were initially built for, many of them out in Cornwall and Devon, they were found to be unsuitable for, and then the lines still remained in service even after the Pacers were withdrawn from them and other rolling stock was sent back down. And interestingly, their research of the record suggests that actually BR knew and, for various reasons, chose the Pacer, even though they knew that it wasn't actually the best choice when compared to the proposed sprinter trains. This comes into one of my favourite things, which is the Pacer was kind of about a solution that appeared to be cheap.
Yes.
It wasn't necessarily that much cheaper, if at all cheaper, but it appeared to be cheap. And for the politicians, it sounded to be cheaper. And to an extent, the HST falls into that category as well when compared to the APT, because the HST sounds like it should be a cheaper solution. You're running faster trains on existing lines. You don't need to build new track. You don't need to do resignaling. You don't need to invest in tilting trains. All this new tech that's needed for the APT, we don't need that for the HST, because the HST is basically just an evolution of your loco hall coaching stock, but a little bit faster.
Yeah, and with a bit more of a pointy front.
But notably, the HST, as I say, is not really a revolutionary concept. We'd already had 100 mile an hour service regularly with the Deltics. Mm.
And the West Coast main line.
Also,
the West Coast main line also had your electrified services, which were doing 110.
Yeah. And also of note is the growing narrative and understanding of the fact that actually, potentially, the HST was bad for Britain's railways. It certainly had an important role in boosting usership of intercity services, but it actually damaged local services. So, for example, there are various examples of stations. I cannot for the life of me remember the name of it out on the West Coast main line that has one train a day in one direction. There's, is it Pilning down on the Great Western main line? And there's several stations between Berwick-upon-Tweed and Newcastle and York that get extremely limited service because the 125 mile an hour trains running down those stretches of line mean you can't stop local services at those stations regularly because they would get in the way.
Yeah, and you've got two tracks often when you need to stop, and obviously you can't just stop a train.
Yeah, and then you get the fact that that means that we've essentially sacrificed local services for intercity services, and then that also feeds into conversations about HS2 and high-speed rail in Britain, where we're sort of like, oh, but we've already got high-speed trains, so why do we need HS2? When the answer is actually the problem we have is we're trying to run high-speed trains on a local, on what should really be a local or inter-regional network.
And this is one of these kind of falsehoods again, where people assume that Britain's railways kind of have it all as well, and I think we see this a lot in the media too, that British railways do have, they kind of forget that we don't actually have true proper high speed lines in the modern sense of the word.
Insert momentary Gareth Dennis moment to talk about the Selby diversion.
Yes, apart from places like that, yes. But the idea that you have dedicated lines whose job is to move the big fast trains away from all the little slow trains, and that's not to say that they shouldn't end up interacting, as we see in places like France and Germany, where you have your high-speed trains ending up in the same terminals, often in the same platforms as your regional service or your local service. But the important thing is when they need to go to do their intercity work, they disappear off. Whereas in Britain, they have to share the track. And
exactly.
But that's also part of the narrative that we've built up, is that, that Britain has these high speed lines, and people will point to things like the West Coast, where you do have somewhat dedicated fast lines, but are they actually high speed? And are they actually for the service, or are they actually causing problems for local services?
Yeah. And on the other hand, as I mentioned earlier, you get the APT getting a bit of a reprieve more recently within the narrative, and notes that actually there were successes within it, and there were successes within the project. For example, it all encompassed things like the research into the high-speed freight wagon that sort of gave information about hunting oscillation and how to run vehicles faster, that have played important roles on everything from the Pacer up to the ICE and the TGV, and those sort of understanding of that science.
Yeah, and...
But also data on how to do tilting trains and how to improve that reliability that fed into things like the Electra 225 and the Class 390s.
Yeah. And even simple things like how do you construct a coach? Which seems like a dumb question to ask, but a lot of British Rail was still in the, we take an underframe, we take a tin can, and we weld the two together. Whereas the APT, it's a whole kind of, it's a monocoque construction, which is an entirely different way of building a train, and requires different skills, different methods, different designs, because we don't build concrete buildings the same way we build a brick building or a wooden building, because each material and each method has its own advantages, has its own strengths and its own weaknesses.
And but then the key thing here, of course, with the APT is we view it and we go, well, why did the APT, if the APT wasn't a technological dead end, then why did it fail and why did the HST succeed? And that allows us actually to understand the history and go, well, actually, one of the problems with the big problem with the APT was the fact the government just would not allow BR to just keep spending money on research. So the APT fails, not because it's a technological failure, but because British Rail does not have the political will to just pour resources endlessly into it. Whereas the HST succeeds because it is a simple project. It's a simple thing. It's easy to get off the ground. And that helps us to better understand the successes and limits of the model of operation that British Rail is operating within, and its financial and political and structural frameworks. And that helps better inform our discourse about how we might improve the future of the rail. And I think that feeds into one of my big bugbears. I've seen it recently. There was an article in The Spectator that was sort of like, history is all about looking backwards and all of that. And I'm sitting there, right, but it's not. It's about looking forwards.
I think most of history is about looking forwards, and it's about using the past as a way to understand and inform our future.
Yeah, there's the oft used quote, those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. And that's the important part of history, is it's about improving the future by understanding what's come before. Because if we don't understand the lessons we've learned, if we don't understand the data we've gathered, if we don't understand the mistakes we made before, how can we ever hope to make better decisions, more informed decisions in the future? And this is why I'm all in favour of changing historiography and revisionism, because part of the factors of that is people going back and re-examining stuff and going, actually, does the primary information say what the past sources have said? But also it's a result of allowing people who have been historically excluded from being part of the historical discussion in, and they bring in their own views. you think traditionally history is carried out by hobby historians, let's call them that.
Yes.
And I'm guilty of this myself, because I do this podcast and I do my history work because I have a reasonably well-paying job that gives me lots of time off.
Hmm.
And that enables me to spend, like, I do 2 days a week and get paid enough to live. And that enables me to pursue my hobby of writing a podcast and researching history. The problem is that we need to change that, because we need to enable those who are less fortunate, who don't have access to that sort of ability to do history because they've got some sort of independent wealth, to reinterpret and be involved in that, because we need those other voices.
Yeah, and I think in some ways this is where I am quite lucky, in that I don't actually make much money. I work one day a week for not very much pay, but I am lucky enough in that I am supported both in part by the state through the student financing system, and in part by my university through dissertation grants, and in part through external organizations who want someone to write and look at the history from a different perspective. If you can demonstrate that you have an interesting opinion or an interesting standpoint, and they're willing to come and say, well, yes, please come and look at this. Here is some money for you to access material, which for me, my material is quite literally a flight, and there's a massive body of water between me and it. It's not like I can just walk down and see lots of it.
Yeah, and this is the thing that's very important, and why I'm always pleased to see the increasing attempts to involve minority groups, or to re-explore and examine the histories of minority groups, both on the railway and more generally.
Mm.
But you look at projects, like, we're very familiar with sort of projects to explore the role of women in the railways. That's that's now a well-established historical field. But you've got growing fields looking at the history of LGBTQ people within the railway. Yep. Or one of the most interesting and exciting explorations of ignored and deliberately buried history on the railway. And you can tell, and you can see that it's deliberately buried, by the response that established historians had to it when it came up on Twitter. And that is the role of the British Railways and their links with slavery, that the NRM is opening up the books on and doing research on. And that I find as a very interesting, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what those researchers pull out and re-understanding that history. And I think the response that that proposal's received, and when that information, it was what, about a year ago, year and a half ago now, just as lockdown was coming in, that the first discussions about that narrative, and like literally the first mainstream discussions. So as I understand it, there's one or two researchers that had been doing some side, been doing some level of research before into the topic, but about a year and a half ago now, 2 years ago now, there was a big discussion on railway history Twitter discussing that this was a thing, and you got people like friend of the show Gareth Dennis pushing this discussion and saying, look, this is a thing. And then you've got established historians who, for whatever reason, don't want to actually engage with that as a thing, either because it challenges their own view of the world, or their own view of the history, or their position as an authoritative source, because it questions why it's missing from their text. And you have them pushing back and saying, actually, it's not a thing, it doesn't matter. And then, since then, we've had the NRM come out and say, actually, this is, there is stuff here, there is history here, and we need to understand it. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes from that project.
Yes, and I think as is in the notes as well, it's important to recognise that a lot of the history that does exist is by those who are very much into the technical side and the the viewing it as it was better in many ways side.
Yes. You get a lot of rose, like when you're looking at a lot of railway history books, you get a lot of rose-tinted spectacles. You get a lot of people of, a lot of people write about the railways. It's a crossover again with railway modelling as well, that you get a lot of people modelling the railways of when they were little, and you get a lot of people writing about the railways when they were little and remembering the good old days of being a kid.
But was it actually as good is an important question.
And so
you get people cherry picking. I was going to say, you get people cherry picking ideas and concepts as being this was how it was done everywhere. And I think we even see this to an extent on heritage lines. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, as quite frankly, they're a tourist attraction. They're there for fun.
There is an episode for Rails to Nowhere somewhere at some point discussing heritage lines, because I think they're an absolutely fascinating
They are fascinating as a concept, but then they're also only presenting a very limited scope as to what the system was actually like. And while, yes, you had, you know, these railways have the, quite frankly, the time and the money to do things like shine up the brass every morning and make and put on this beautifully upholstered service and fine dining for all and so on. But for the average person using British Rail, when those trains would have been running around in their heyday, they were likely to be covered in grubbiness because there wasn't time to shine up the brass. And there was, and often most people weren't in the first class car having the lovely buffet dinner, but were instead slumming it back in third class, you know, smoking and trying to read a newspaper in peace while someone snored next to them.
Yeah, and I always think that when you see stuff like with the Brighton Bell being restored, and you occasionally get a news article, they'll be like, oh yeah, see what travel was like in the age of steam and in the 1920s. You're like, well, only if you were rich.
Yeah, because that was an exclusive service. It was massively expensive.
We both went on, I know we both recently went on the Transport Museum's runs of the 1938 stock. And again, build a sort of see what experience travel on the underground as it would have been in the 20s. But it wasn't, because everyone had a seat and everyone, and the train was like really laid back and whatever. And like,
everyone.
But that's not really how travel would have been in the 20s.
And so it's.
And these things have their place, but they, but it's also important to recognise that often these things can be misleading in their actual accurate portrayal. Yes. And if you look at the archive pictures, you you begin to understand that actually things weren't as brilliant as that.
Yes, and I think some of the people involved in these too do understand as well, because I had a discussion with the, I forget their name, I do hope they can forgive me, but the old gentleman who was in charge of the actual, like, their job was to look after this train, basically be the person who oversees it. And we were discussing about, well, this is set up, this car we're standing in here by and having our chat in is set up like it's a 1950s era train. The Northern Line stickers are from, we managed to date them to within a couple years. But is this actually a true representation? Because the train is now comprising of, like, bits from, you know, stock ranging from over 100 years old to recently 2012 withdrawn A stock. Is this actually what it was like? Well, no. And also, like, we're sitting here, I'm not being coughed to death by someone who's smoking a pipe.
So, and this is sort of the important thing with sort of viewing the whole historical picture. And I think all of these things have important roles for engaging people in history. But it's also important that we're actually engaging academically, thinking critically. One of the big things that historical study does is it teaches you critical thinking. It teaches you to view things with a healthy level of skepticism, to question what you're looking at. And when I see news articles that say that history has no significant role for the modern world, and that, like, oh, we can all just be hobby historians. It angers me, because this idea that we can all be hobby historians, or that the only historians that we need are hobby historians, or that history is just a series of facts. It is facts, it's dates and figures. This happened. It's just facts. There's no room for interpretation. It angers me, because the importance of history is in the nuance. It's in the understanding, the reinterpretation, the understanding, the meaning behind things. Like, I always say, like, a good historian doesn't need to know dates and facts and figures, because I can go and I can look at an encyclopedia, or I can look at Wikipedia or whatever, and I can find out the dates and the exact day that something happened. A good historian is someone who can look at sources and read them, understand them within the context, and sort of provide a contextual view on what's going on, what these sources mean, why they're important, what messages are trying to be told, what story is trying to be told, and help us to understand what lessons that might teach us for the modern world. And so that's why I get really angry when I see news articles that sort of just say, oh, we all just need to be focusing on STEM. STEM's what's important. STEM's what will teach us the lessons we need for today. History is just a hobby thing. And again, the idea that history can just be a hobby, because that means it's only people like me who have the financial capability to spend time doing a hobby, because our work doesn't tire us out. No. History should be well paid, it should be well resourced, it should be accessible to all, it should be accessible to every demographic in society, because all of them come with their own story, their own view on the world, their own understanding. And if a piece of historical research makes you feel uncomfortable, that is not the fault of the historical research, because that historical research is asking you questions. And if something like the big one at the minute is looking at the British Empire, trying to re-understand that in the sense of the racist attitudes that prevailed within it, and if that makes you feel uncomfortable, if questions about, well, is Britain racist, make you feel uncomfortable, you need to understand that actually it is. And just because those voices were not talked about, were not heard before, because the way history has been done in the past has not enabled those people with those voices to engage with it. The fact that our understanding of history and the way history is being understood now is changing is good, because we are enabling, because don't get me wrong, it is way off being fixed. It's way off being perfect. But we are enabling black people. We are enabling women. We are enabling LGBTQ people. We are enabling minority groups to become engaged in history. And that is vital and important, because we cannot build a better world if we do not understand the reality and the truth of our past. And if all you think history is going, well, the Battle of Hastings happened in 1066, Henry VIII was crowned on this day, London Transport came into being in 1933. If that's all you think history is, if you think it's just a series of dates to be listed by rote, you do not understand what history is. And I will happily sit down with you and give you another hour's talk like we've done today.
Yes.
And I will happily go through with you, yes, about why this is.
And I think as well, being uncomfortable and asking questions that even you find uncomfortable is key. And it's also, quite frankly, it's also a life skill too. Because if you can't ask difficult questions, if you can't question, is this actually what we have thought true? Is what we have done racist? Is what has been written actually very much a cherry-picked and rose-tinted interpretation of what happened, you will only ever end up thinking that everything is wonderful and that anything can just, anything just happens, it's all good. And if you find it difficult to ask uncomfortable questions, and it is difficult, if you find it something you feel like you can avoid, I personally think that there's a lot to that you need to ask yourself too, because I think a lot of the questions that I sit about asking make people uncomfortable in different ways. And some of the questions that I asked regarding the Jersey occupation made some people very uncomfortable out there, because I was asking the question, were there people who were working with the Nazi occupiers? And there were, but there are reasons for that. And if you understand why the reasons are, then you can understand more about your society. And I think I'm going to stray into potentially dangerous waters here and say, like, some of the questions that I sit about with other people and ask about something like the state of Israel, they're questions that make some people that I speak to incredibly uncomfortable, and they do all they can to avoid the topic around me because they know that I will ask a question that will make them uncomfortable. But that is not because I want to make them uncomfortable, but
it's because we want to understand the truth. We want to examine it, and we want to build a better future.
Yes, because we see a lot of stuff now. We see in Germany, in East Germany, the rise of something like AfD. And in Britain, I think we've seen the rise in recent years of more right-wing views that refuse to ask questions about our past. I mean, if you look at our current government, they are, and our previous government too, at time of recording, they have been very careful to avoid asking questions about the past, and in many ways have done all they can to stop questions being asked about the past. But actually, maybe these questions are very important. Actually, they are some of the people who could most benefit from having these questions asked and thought about.
Yep.
Which is difficult. And it is difficult, and it is scary as well to face that not everything is not perfect.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And
we've gone to some dark places now.
Yeah. But we always were going to in this episode. We're always going to be talking about these things, but it's important that we are, and it's important that we do, and it's important that we remember that the right to ask these questions and the capacity to ask these questions is protected and stood up for, because it is a vital part of our democracy that we can ask these questions about our past, both on the railway and beyond. Because it all influences how we understand the past and how we understand where we're trying to get to the future.
Yes, and also the other thing as well is it helps us understand why we are where we are.
Yeah,
because if we don't
and who
understand
we are as
where
people.
We are, we don't succeed as a society. No. I think.
No, so I think that brings us pretty much to the end of our list of things we wanted to talk about. I think that's pretty much a good conclusion point. This episode, I think, sitting here listening to it, basically I think there's only like 2 points that I need to go and edit back in this, so that's a good achievement on this recording.
Yes, this is going to be much chat.
Yeah, so I'm leaving, I'm properly like going all sort of well, there's your problem on this, and I'm going to leave all of the pauses in this episode. I'm not going through and editing out all the pauses like I do for a main episode.
And I'm think it's also important to recognise that I know the audio might be a bit you know, bodged together because
this is the first thing we've recorded in 6 months.
And we're back to remote recording because it's
because
difficult to do in person.
We don't currently have an in-person place to record yet.
No.
But before we go, a massive thank you to all of you who can hear this, because you are our patrons, and you have meant that this year we've been running the podcast for just over a year now. I know we've not put out anywhere near the amount of stuff that we had hoped. So first of all, thank you all for sticking with us. We know it's a little infrequent, but thank you all for sticking with us and supporting us. And thank you for your support, because it's meant that this year, when we've come to renew things like our Podbean license and our URLs, we didn't need to worry about where that money was coming from. We've been able to use the Patreon money to keep our systems going. Thank you for supporting us. As I say, I've now finished my MA.
Yes.
One of the big reasons we've not been able to put episodes out much lately is because we've both been working on our dissertations, and our dissertations took way more energy and effort than we had realized they would. I'm obviously not doing that anymore, so it means I've got more time to do research.
I will.
So do expect Ella researched episodes, because there will be Ella researched episodes. But the big thing is, it means that I can be doing research for this rather than focusing on my dissertation. And then I just need to grab Ella for an hour and a half to do a recording.
Yes.
So hopefully we'll be able to put out a few more episodes.
And also the other thing is, I think the one thing that we can say is the massive time gaps that we have are evident of what this episode is actually about. Because if we're to do proper historiography and proper give you a proper history as such, it's a bad term, proper, but you know what I mean, I think
we can all agree. Detailed, in depth.
Yes, it takes a lot of time, because you can sit down with a document and go, oh yeah, this is what the document's about, but then you'll go back from your trip to the archive or to view a source, and then you'll go, oh my god, there is so much more than I ever thought there was.
And I think the way I'm planning to put the Patreon feed out, you should have heard the second episode of BR Tech by the time this bonus comes out. But we were meant to be recording that today, but then I've gone on the National Archive website and discovered a whole heap of other sources that I want to look at before recording that episode.
Yes.
So we're recording it out of order. Which is why partially I'm speculating about what will appear in that second episode as earlier points in this. Anyway, thank you all for listening to this Patreon special episode of Rails to Nowhere. I think, given the topic of this, at some point it will go live on the full feed, but not for a little while, because you are our patrons and we like to give you some extra special stuff.
Yes,
thank you for listening.
Yes.
Do follow us on Twitter at Rails to Nowhere. I think that's our Twitter handle.
Yes, you mostly do the tweeting, because I try to keep myself away from the Twitter because it's full of things that make me very angry.
at Rails to Nowhere on Twitter. You can also find me at Red Dragon Tweets, where I tweet about the various adventures that I do on the railway. Ella does not have a Twitter, I'm afraid you can't spy on her. But thank you for listening, and tune in next time on Rails to Nowhere, which should be our third and final episode of British Rail and Technologic.